For a final medical oncology perspective on lung cancer, I met with Dr. David Ettinger, who began by commenting on a critical recent and rapidly developing issue discussed by prior speakers, the role of tumor histology in treatment selection.
What's practice changing, and it's come full circle now, is the use of histology, different subsets of histology and the effectiveness of different agents. The first inkling of that came out by Dr. Scagliata at the ISLAC meeting, looking at pemetrexate cysts versus GEM cysts, showing that squamous cell did better in GEM cysts, while patients with squamous cell did better with GEM cisplatin, while with adenocarcinoma, pemetrexate cisplatin did better. Patients with adenocarcinoma did better.
And that just got published in the JCO.
And that's published in JCO. That's been now duplicated with the same drug several times. There are some data sets, I want to say, with biologics. I mean, we know that, obviously, Avastin adenocarcinoma, you're not going to use it in squamous cell. Cetuximab, you can use it with either. I think those are the ones that have interested me. Yeah. There are, and I brought some notes. It wasn't actually an ASCO presentation of one of the biologics, which let me get the information, because I think it's very specific in the sense that not a big study. It was presented by Dr. Karp looking at, it's a IGF-IR1 antagonist, and the highest levels of IGF-1 are in squamous subtypes. So he presented an abstract of a phase 2 study of CP-751871 plus carbo and paclitaxel in Vance disease. And in 7 out of 9 squamous cells, it was a dose-finding study, had a response, that is 78%. That was part of a randomized trial. In the single-arm trial with the squamous cell, 11 out of 14. While in adeno, it was 16 out of 28, 57%. So here is a biologic based on overexpression that might be significant.
Let's talk a little bit about the FLEX data that was presented in the ASCO at a plenary session. Can you summarize sort of what your take was of the key points from that, what you thought about Tom Lynch's discussion, and kind of how you're all putting it together right now in your own head?
Well, I think I'm a believer that the goal of the therapy should give patients the best quality of life for the longest period of time. And the idea of a biologic down the road, you can look at multiple targets to put with combination chemotherapy. If you look at the cetuximab data, the overall survival of 6 weeks was statistically significant, yet the progression-free survival was no different. That relates to another issue, because there are studies, phase 3 studies, that look at progression-free survival as an endpoint, which is they're trying to get the data out sooner as a surrogate. And here's an example of where the progression-free survival was no different, but the survival was different, 6 weeks. And remember, they took patient population that was EGFR positive on immunohistochemical stain, and all they had to do was have one cell positive. That's 85% of the patients had that, at least that, so they had a big numbers of patients. The study showed that Asians overall did well, but they did well in the chemotherapy as well, while the Caucasian population did better with the cetuximab data. And the toxicity was reasonable in what you'd expect. In bevacizumab-ineligible patients, I think cetuximab is a reasonable choice.
Yeah, it's interesting because the benefit was somewhat modest. On the other hand, there's nothing too exciting right now for the bev-ineligible type patients. And I've been surprised that I hear kind of the same message that you just said, that it is a consideration. I guess certainly the fact that there's no serious complications, but there are the dermatologic issues. How do you think that's going to play out in clinical practice? I mean, have you used cetuximab yet in any
patient? Well, I did a study of cetuximab and erlotinib together, and this major toxicity was skin rash.
I'll bet.
And the most serious of the skin rash we had was grade 3, and yet that was the best response we had. So can you put those two drugs together? Maybe with some difficulty. I think, you know, if you look at the skin rash in erlotinib, there are patients that get it bad, and of course the skin rash is associated with a better response the worse the skin rash. Do patients like it? Not particularly. Do patients like the fatigue associated with the drug? Not particularly. So I think you got to weigh the risks versus the benefits. I think what is more telltale about, and I thought you were going to ask the question of, are all patients eligible for Avastin getting it? And the answer is no. And I think there's two reasons. One, I think the doctor has a bias of who they're going to put the patient on. Some is related to cost. And the other, the patient has a bias when they hear all the side effects of stroke, bleeding. And remember, we're talking about less than 5%.
versus a lethal disease in 100%.
Yes, so I don't minimize it, but I say look at the risk versus the benefit. And remember, the response rate to bevacizumab with chemotherapy is something like 34% versus then less than 20% in the studies, that 4599 ECOG study. And I think they're loosening up the requirements based on some of the work of showing that you can give it with brain mets, you can give it up in patients that have been on anticoagulants. So I think you're going to see a loosening up of the eligibility. I think what's more critical is really I'd like to see the studies that are going to use bevacizumab and cetuximab with chemotherapy. I think if you're going to advance the field, the idea to me is to advance the field. So do I look at the cetuximab data as earth-shaking? The answer is no. Do I look at it as a building block to the next level or next advance? The answer is yes. And I think the goal really is to make stage four disease a chronic disease.
I guess in terms of the issue of cetuximab and bevacizumab in colon cancer, there have been a couple of trials, actually one at ASCO, Cairo 2, and then the PACE study prior to that. Of course, they're different diseases, but not too positive results.
Yeah, well, we don't even have to go further than that. We could say, look at the AVAIL study, which was bevacizumab with gemcitabine cisplatin, and it wasn't a positive study survival-wise. Now, do we say maybe the problem is, you know, if you look at the NCCN guidelines, we didn't say with bevacizumab you can use it with any regimen. There may be differences between regimens that you can use these drugs to. That has to be investigated.
What about the type of chemotherapy utilized or that you might consider utilizing with cetuximab?
Well, right now, I'm going to use it with vinorelbine and cisplatin. That's the way the study was designed. Understand something. This drug has already been used with Taxol carboplatin. Lynch presented that data, and there was just a press release by Dr. Rowinsky saying that the survival data wasn't statistically significant, but the study wasn't powered to meet that. There were over 300-some-odd patients. I'm not sure that is legitimate since it was a phase 3 study.
Getting back to bevacizumab, you mentioned the fact that, you know, it's not being utilized in as many patients as theoretically would be eligible. A lot of people in practice have concerns or thoughts about the issue of where the tumor is located, centrally versus distant, and yet the investigators say they don't see a difference there.
Well, I think the one thing that I do follow is the appropriate patients that the ECOG study 4599 used. I do not give it in squamous cell. I do not give it in central lesions. And I'm going to knock on wood if I can find it because I've not seen the bleeding, which other people have. So I try to follow with that group of patients using bevacizumab the appropriate indications.
What are your thoughts about the issue of bevacizumab in trials in the adjuvant setting? We have a big colon trial we're waiting for data on. Breast cancer is looking at a bunch of other tumors, and there's also a lung trial, the ECOG study.
1505, I think it's a great study. And the reason it is a great study, because there's been no advance in adjuvant therapy in a while. And as a matter of fact, what's even more frightening is at ASCO this year, the ALT study gave 10-year data, and Le Chavalier showed that the survival advantage was not there at 10 years. And what was interesting, there were more deaths in the chemotherapy arm than it was in the control arm. And the second primary was exactly the same. And then they also pointed out that if they were ERCC negative, they analyzed the data for ERCC negative, whether the patient's going to respond to cisplatin, the negative patients did better than the patients that were ERCC positive. They looked at 761 patients. So, you know, I think that points to the fact that there are now several academic institutions that are talking about on their patients with metastatic disease, and even with if you can get the tissue, is to do a battery of studies looking at ERCC1, RMM1, thymidinic synthetase to see if you would react to pemetrexate. There are developing tests for whether you're going to respond to a taxane or not. I think we're talking about personalized medicine. Is that the future? That is the future.
So are you yourself using any of those markers outside of a trial?
Well, we're trying to get our laboratories, our path to do them on all the tissue we could do it. But who's going to pay for it? It's labor intensive. If I was sitting with lung cancer, I'd request my laboratory to do it. Now, can they routinely do it? No. Are there companies, Genzyme and others, trying to develop tests to be able to do it? I think, obviously, there are laboratories working on this. But you need tissue. You need to have standards to make sure it's accurate. I mean, those are the critical issues.
What about the issue of markers in terms of determining whether to use cetuximab? You mentioned that IHC was used in the study, although it only excluded about 15% of the patients. There's also been data from Hirsch looking at FISH as a predictor of response to cetuximab. Where do you think that's heading?
Oh, I think you're going to start, because the cost of the drugs are so prohibitive and that the survival advantage, say, in the cetuximab study is only 6 weeks, you want to give the patients the best shot at who's going to respond. I think you're going to have more and more markers rather than less. I think you're going to start seeing KRAS, both as, say, in the small molecule, both as a predictive marker and a prognostic marker. If you have it, you're in trouble.
One of the things that's interesting about the adjuvant trial is the fact that they require cis-based chemo, can be with either docetaxel, vinorelbine, or GEM. How do you approach patients in terms of selection of adjuvant chemo off study?
Well, in the adjuvant setting, it's cisplatinum-based. I like gemcitabine, and so that's the one I would choose. Obviously, if they can't tolerate cisplatinum, it's carboplatin. I think the bigger issue is going to be when pemetrexate gets approved, where does pemetrexate fit in, and especially in the adenos? And if you add that as one of the regimens, you have to be careful because do you stratify, if that's more effective, what happens over time? It can be a really effective study.
Also, I'm hearing a lot of interest in carbopemetrexate Bev. Is that a combination that you utilize?
Well, it would be an interesting regimen because the Bev is effective in adenocarcinoma and the pemetrexate is effective in adenocarcinoma. So if it's approved for first line, it'll be a very interesting regimen to use.
What about management of locally advanced disease, chemoradiation, maintenance? Where are we with that?
Well, first of all, I think the other reason to get to know how to use cetuximab is, of course, based on Blumenschein's RTOG study that he presented, where the median survival of cetuximab with concurrent chemoradiation was 22.7 months. Which is the highest RTOG has ever had. When you talk about sequential chemo radiation, you're talking about a 14-month median survival. When you talk about concurrent, you're talking about 17 months. Now it's 22.7 months based on a phase 2 data. And now the intergroup study, which compared two different doses, 74 and 60 gray with concurrent chemo radiation, is now going to add cetuximab to each of those, with and without cetuximab, that is. So you're going to be able to determine whether cetuximab is of value. It should be based on what we know about cetuximab and concurrent chemo radiation with head and neck malignancy. So I think that's one issue. The other
issue, incidentally, would you consider cetuximab and the chemo radiation situation off study?
I would, although we have studies, several studies. So I think what's going to be the rate limiting factor there off study is if the insurance companies are going to pick up the tab. If they don't pick up the tab, I think there's a different issue. And I think that's going to drive a lot of care. Wealthy patients, never an issue. Middle class and poor, an issue. And, of course, it depends on what kind of insurance you have. It's one thing having a $10, $20 copay. It's another thing having a 20% copay. 20% of, say, $3,500 is a lot of money. That's an issue. I think the other issue, of course, we alluded to in maintenance, was the docetaxel and stage 3B. The original SWOG study, when Gandara presented, was only stage 3B, that is non-pleural effusion 3B. The HANA study had 3A and 3B in it, and when you looked at the data comparing 3B to 3B SWOG, they were exactly the same. And then he presented it again at ASCO. In other words, the curves, the survival curves were the same. And he presented the data again, looking at it a little differently now. And the feeling is maybe docetaxel is not the right drug for maintenance, and maybe it should be something else. If a patient is getting concurrent chemotherapy with radiation, and you only give, say, VP platinum times two, my own feeling is the patient should get some chemotherapy afterwards. And in my situation, I would probably give concurrent chemo, that is combination chemotherapy. And right at the moment, if I'm treating an adenocarcinoma, it'd probably be pemetrexate, carboplatin, or something like that. What is interesting is I probably can justify it because it'd be second line, if you will.
What were your thoughts about the paper presented at ASCO looking at pemetrexate maintenance? Can you kind of review what was looked at and what your thoughts were about it?
Well, the study took several combination chemotherapeutic regimens and then randomized in a 2-to-1 randomization between pemetrexate versus a placebo. Both groups got vitamin B12 folate and dexamethasone. What it didn't do is, and the study wasn't designed to do it, was to do immediate versus delayed. The year before, we had the Phidias study, which took docetaxel and take the same population of patients randomized between immediate docetaxel or delayed docetaxel when you had progression. And the immediate showed a better response rate, but it didn't show an overall survival rate either. And the progression-free survival was better as well. So it didn't show. So now you have conflicting data. That is, you know, here's a study. And by the way, it also showed that the adenocarcinomas did better than the, that is, the maintenance with the pemetrexate. For those of us that have been doing this a long time, whether you treated breast cancer in 1980 or so, or lung cancer, or colon cancer, once the patient had metastatic disease, they were on chemotherapy till they died. And when things changed to get off chemotherapy, patients actually felt pretty good. And now we've almost come full circle to say, do patients have to get maintenance therapy? Will this right study be done? The answer is probably not. In other words, delayed versus immediate.
I mean, you do have the issue of chemotherapy holidays in colon cancer that they've explored a lot. How do you approach the situation yourself outside of protocol setting?
You know, I haven't been giving maintenance therapy. I think the trickier part is going to be you put a patient on bevacizumab plus chemotherapy, give them 4 to 6 cycles, and then you leave them on, based on the ECOG study, the bevacizumab. You're left with then stable disease. Do you add pemetrexate? There are studies looking at Bev and pemetrexate, cetuximab, pemetrexate. If you think about it for a second, that might be very valuable data, but I think you need a study to show it. The one thing I am sure of, the cost of that is astronomical. You're talking about bevacizumab, $8,000 to $11,000 every 3 weeks, and the pemetrexate is not cheap either.
What about small cell cancer? Anything new there?
Yeah, I think the new stuff is actually, I'm not going to toot my own horn, was amirubicin, whereby in refractory disease it had a 17.4% response rate. And in comparing, and Dr. Jotte, J-O-T-T-E, presented the comparison in the sensitive disease, comparing it to topotecan, and it had a 34% response rate versus 4% response rate. Phase 2 study.
What's the agent?
Amirubicin. Amrubicin. It's an anthracycline. It was originally developed in Japan. And the question came up, does effectiveness cross the Pacific? And I guess it does. This is a drug now, the original studies with Pharmion, now it's brought out by Celgene, and hopefully we'll make some advances in that area, because we haven't made an advance in small cell in a long time. The other study was looking at high dose, low dose, PCI. It was a standard dose versus high dose. You're going to use standard dose. The irinotecan data from SWOG didn't show any different than the VP Platinum. As a matter of fact, it was more diarrhea based on genomic changes. Then there was a study looking at topotecan, cisplatinum versus VP Platinum. In my opinion, well, there was no difference, but in my opinion, why would you use topotecan cis? Because VP 16 cis was less toxic.
Let's talk a little bit about cancer of unknown primary.
If you take a look at the carcinoma of unknown primary, you know that that's essentially, for the most part, by definition, it's an incurable disease. And you really want to rule out 5 diseases, what is potentially curable. And those 5 are breast, ovary can live a long time, prostate, thyroid, and germ cell tumors. All the others, whether it be lung, colon, you can design a regimen, it's still a bad situation. So, for example, if you had an axillary mass, and even though the mammogram is negative, and that's the only thing, you might err on the side and treat that as a breast cancer patient. If you had a midline tumor in a young person, you might err on the side and treat that as a germ cell tumor. And Dr. Greco from the Sarah Cannon Cancer Institute has shown some elegant studies of the midline tumors treating as germ cell tumors with high response rates and better survival rates. And I think where we're getting better now is a whole host of immunohistochemical stains to really try to delineate where the possibility is the tumor is from, and then make an educated guess, if you will, on how to treat the patient. The problem is, as a physician, if the patient has a metastatic disease, you try to pigeonhole that and say common things are common. Patient has, say, bone, pleura, adrenal gland, liver, and it's a male smoker, you'd say that's lung. The problem is, in an adeno of unknown primary, it behaves differently. It may not be true. The other thing is, the patient thinks, if the doctor knows where the primary is coming from, he's going to be able to do better or she's going to be able to do better in treating. That's a fallacy as well. As long as you rule out the five I mentioned previously.